Hello and welcome to another edition of the Capitol Record. I'm your host, David Bahnsen, and Capitol Record is brought to you by National Review's Capitol Matters. The shared goal that we have in this podcast with National Review and our Capitol Matters endeavor is the defense of a free society, the defense of free enterprise and robust capital markets. And I've decided to use today's podcast to do this in a way that may be totally unthinkable for so many on the economic right. Many of my well-meaning, libertarian-oriented, free enterprise-defending friends have decided over the years, partially, I guess, at times, because they've believed there to be too much overreach or something from the Christian right or from the social right, the Family Values Coalition, what have you. But there has been created from many folks in this movement a kind of distinction between what President Reagan used to refer to and talk about and think about as multiple legs of the same stool. We now are told that areas related to family, areas related to culture are separated from economic laws, economic outcomes, economic ideals. Well, my guest today doesn't agree, and I don't agree either. And so while some of this podcast today may delve into some issues that you think are outside of free enterprise and capital markets, I understand. Bear with us if you can. I think we're going to tie it all together, and I'm going to have some concluding thoughts at the end. But I can't think of anyone better equipped to make the case that, in fact, strong family unit and social ideals are very much integrated with our belief in a free society, but also a economically prosperous one, and one that keeps its commitments, that has a high view of contract law, that has a kind of virtue embedded that we believe is necessary to underpin free enterprise. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. I got to first meet Jennifer well over 10 years ago through the Acton Institute, although she by then had started the Ruth Institute that she continues to head to this day. And I'm going to let her tell you her story, but she is academic economist by training, former professor at Yale at George Mason, and wrote a book called Love and Economics nearly two decades ago that I found to be profoundly innovative in the way she brings together our created purpose for love with what we believe about economic order. So allow me to bring in to Capitol Record today, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. So with that said, welcome to another episode of Capitol Record, and welcome to another first-time guest, my old friend, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. Jennifer, welcome to Capitol Record.
Thanks for having me on, David.
So I mentioned in the intro kind of a little bit about our background and where we first met each other, spoken together over the years at a couple of Acton Institute events. I've read, I believe, every book you've written and have been such a tremendous fan of your work for a long time. But I think it would be better for National Review's Capitol Record listeners to just sort of hear from you a little bit about your background and what you've been working on in your life's work.
Oh, well, thank you very much. So, gosh, David, I don't even remember when you and I first picked up the story, but my most recent book is called The Sexual State, How Elite Ideologies Are Destroying Lives and Why the Church is Right All Along. And basically that book is saying that the sexual revolution was not some impersonal cultural force, but rather was organized by people who wanted it for various reasons. And it was all very much of a top-down kind of thing, and that people need to be aware of that and be looking out for the propaganda surrounding it. And that Christians need to be unashamed to defend the traditional teachings around human sexuality and sexual morality and lifelong marriage and so on, that these things, that the traditional teaching can be defended at the highest level of sophistication. And my background actually is in economics. My doctorate's in economics. I taught at George Mason. I taught at Yale. And I left teaching because we had two children within 6 months' time. We adopted a little boy from a Romanian orphanage when he was 2.5 years old. And then 6 months later, we gave birth to a little girl. And having those two kids at the same time basically showed my husband and me that children really do need their parents. You know, the idea that adults can do whatever they want, the kids are so resilient, it's all going to be fine. That's really not true, you know. And our boy's situation, of course, was rather extreme, you know, profound neglect. But what it showed us is that children need to be in relationship with their parents in order to develop a conscience, in order to develop the basics ability to be social that the whole economy really rests on. That was the period, David, when I was moving away from being a plain vanilla economist. And I was a free market economist, you know, a longtime defender of capitalism and opponent of Marxism and all of that. That's what I did in my early career. But our kids showed me that it's not enough to say, oh, we're going to have a free market where everybody keeps their promises and follows contracts and all that. The people who are capable of doing that, the people who are morally capable of keeping promises, they have to come from somewhere, you know, and they come from a family. They come from a home where mom and dad are taking care of that child and where mom and dad love each other. And that was kind of my first real realization that the church's deeper teaching about all these matters is very important, because the church teaches, and I think all Christian religions agree with this, right? That the human person is meant for love. The human person is meant for love, and the child without love can't even do the most basic things in a society, you know? So that's the kind of the long version. I wrote Love and Economics in 2001. Most of my economist friends had no idea what I was talking about. It was only the economist friends who had some religious background who could relate to what I was saying. And they were very grateful that I had finally spelled out these issues that were, you know, had troubled them in some way, you know, but they couldn't figure out quite how to articulate it. So that's the big picture of who I am and where I am today. Now I run the Ruth Institute, and my kids are all grown up. And I had to invent a job for myself, because once you leave a tenured position, you're essentially unemployable after that. So I started my own organization, the Ruth Institute, which is an interfaith international coalition to defend the family. And that's what I'm doing today.
So every single thing you just said animates me and my belief system. It sits at the core of what I believe a truly holistic understanding of what we call in the podcast, language I borrow from our mutual friend, Father Sirico, the free and virtuous society. And yet I do believe that there are some who would advocate for a free market and who would advocate for a strong family, but they would view that as two separate arguments, two separate, sort of like I like chocolate ice cream and I like vanilla ice cream. And I don't see it that way. And I don't think you do either. I believe that strong families are integral to my defense of free markets. And I believe that free society, free markets, free exchange are integral to the desired strength of the institution, a family that we aspire towards. Is your experience that there is opposition to one versus the other planks in the platform? Do a lot of your old secular, academic, economic friends resist the message about the family? Or is there growing awareness and appreciation for the juxtaposition of these two truths?
Well, I wish I could answer that briefly. I think
don't be brief. Take the time.
Well, it's a complicated question that you're asking, yeah. David. I mean, I think my friends who have some religious background once I pointed it out to them, they had no trouble seeing the connection. Okay. What I do find frustrating is a lot of people who advocate for the free market seem to not realize how much the attack on the family has been part of the deconstruction of the free market. And that goes back to the very beginning. Okay, so Engels and Marx viewed the monogamous family as a big problem for them, and something that they had to attack and something that they felt motivated to take down. And I would say even more strongly, any totalitarian movement you can think of, whether it's Marxism, whether it's fascism, you know, any totalitarian movement you can think of goes after the family, you know, because the family is a problem. If you're trying to control everything everybody does, and you've got these little societies, in a little society, there's someone that everyone loves, namely mommy, and there's somebody that keeps order, namely daddy, you know, and they don't really need anybody else. You know, they're just chugging along doing their thing. And, you know, the family can reproduce itself. I mean, that's kind of what it does, is reproduce. Sexual revolution is sterile, literally sterile. And so if you're trying to control everybody, you got to do something about the family and you got to do something about the church. And that's what every form of, you know, all the modern totalitarianisms that are interwoven with, part and parcel of secularization, this whole secularizing society, they all do that. You know, they all go after the family and they all go after the church, because you can't have people being loyal to something other than the state. I mean, please, you can't have that, you know. So that's part of the answer to your question, David. It's a multifaceted thing.
Yeah, but I think it's a great answer, and it's very helpful. I think that there's a lot of anti-fragility, as Nassim Taleb would refer to it, in the institution of family. You get a sort of, as you said, kind of self-fulfilling protectiveness. There's something about the unconditional love that is supposed to exist inside of a family. That protective nature, it trumps even some of the most conventional of economic self-interest. And so it sort of defies so many conventions that it would make sense that the totalitarian would feel threatened. But I think that the equally interesting point you make is that even philosophically, the Marxes and Engels understood this, that there was, in their view of the human person, they were quite explicit about how a capitalistic structure undermined their view that work was fundamentally undignifying to mm-hmm. mankind, and that man was at war with nature. But with the family, those same philosophical problems existed for Marx. And so it seems to have behooved them to just casually dismiss it. As opposed to with the proletariat, they could advocate a very explicit overthrowing of the capitalistic oppressor. With the family, they more had to undermine it generationally.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. One of our Acton friends pointed this out to me. You know, that when communism collapsed in Europe, you know, in 1989, 1991, that period of time, the left and the Marxist, they did not miss a beat. It's like it never happened. They just kind of shifted their attention over to deconstructing the family, because a lot of their objectives could be achieved in that manner, you know, by going down that path. Okay, yeah, we're not talking about socialism explicitly anymore. That's kind of embarrassing, but we haven't really given up on the dream of a society that is ordered in the way that we think it should be ordered. I mean, I think that's the simplest, you know, most, you know, without getting hysterical about it and, you know, calling them mean names, they have a vision of how they want society to be. And their vision is not entirely consonant with human nature, right? They're trying to remake human nature, which I think is the key point. You kind of alluded to that in what you said. But, you know, it's human nature for man and woman to be drawn to one another. It's human nature for people to favor their own children over other people's children. That right there disrupts equality. See, I mean, you now have people specifically saying that the family You know, they're coming right out and saying it. It's family privilege. We need to deconstruct family privilege because they're admitting our basic point, which is that people with married parents do so much better than people who don't have married parents, right? So it's in a way an admission of defeat, but not because they still have this fantasy in their mind of how they want society to be, and in order to get there, they have to remake human nature. And anybody who wants to remake human nature, I'm sorry, they're up to no good. That's going to end up totalitarian.
And I think that we're at war right now in the battle of ideas with people who have themselves declared war on nature, which is to say, for you and I, and from our theological worldview, a war on creation.
Yep.
But I think we can talk about it more abstractly as nature, and your point is the same. And yet I wonder if we should be content to say that the war on nature is futile because it's a war on nature, that the natural order of things cannot be trumped. But is it more than just futile? Is it in fact fundamentally dangerous, will reap great damage, will do great harm to the cause of human flourishing, disrupt the potential for joy, peace, and harmony in the society along the way, all the while eventually failing? That's where this predictive versus descriptive element is so interesting. Marx was not merely wrong in what he predicted would happen. He was wrong in why he wanted it to happen.
Yes, I think that's right.
And I feel the same way about the family. I do not believe that they will prevail in this endeavor.
So here's the way I put it in the sexual state, David. You've put your finger on, I think, a very key issue. A lot of times conservatives want to say, well, this is doomed. Okay, well, yeah, it's doomed, but that doesn't mean we sit back and just watch it fall apart. You know, that's a bad plan. But the thing that I think is the key to understanding my book, The Sexual State, and what I spell out there, every part of the sexual revolution is in some way at war with nature, whether it's human nature or nature, you know, the idea that sex and babies should be disconnected. I mean, this is basically saying we don't like this fact about the human body and the fact that men and women are different in fundamental ways. We don't like that fact. Yeah. You know, we're all about equality. The fact that children depend upon their parents and their own parents, that biological bodily tie really, really matters. We can't just overwrite that with high quality, low cost daycare, you know, which is what, you know, that was a thing that that people used to talk about. They're way past that now. But every phase, it's an attack on human nature, human embodiment. Here's the key to understanding it. It is not possible to do this, but it takes a lot of power to do the impossible. It takes a lot of propaganda to make people think that it's possible, all right, and to make people go along with the possible. And so if you see this ideology of the sexual revolution, I see it as a pretext for a power grab. If you are about accumulating power for yourself, it doesn't matter that the thing's impossible. In fact, it's okay that it's impossible because you'll always have an excuse for the next round of power grab, see? And I think that is absolutely what is going on with the sexual revolution. You know, I just mentioned these people saying, oh, family privilege, we have to further deconstruct the family. Well, if you were paying attention, you would know that you had just admitted that the social conservatives were right all along, that everybody should get married and stay married before they have kids, right? You could admit that. Well, they don't admit that. They go for the next round of destruction because that feeds the fantasy, but it also empowers the state in various ways. And so That's what I think. I think that's the key to understanding the whole thing. If it's a pretext for a power grab, their behavior makes perfect sense. Otherwise, you look at them and you go, they're crazy. They're just nuts, you know?
Oh, it's a great insight. It's very helpful in the way we think about it. I guess one thing that we ought to address is beyond the ideal of what you and I believe the social order ought to look like. And what we want when we get a chance to talk to young people and share, don't go make this mistake. Here's the playbook for a reasonably successful and happy life, and an obedient and faithful one, by the way, I would add, as a man of faith. But you know, waiting till you have married to have kids, it creates all sorts of benefits and avoids a lot of complexity that is going to make a lot of sense in your life. And I think that you, Ruth Institute, and your work have been devoted to this issue of trying to get in front of it, sort of a preemptive strike on a lot of the social fabric deterioration that we've seen. But I wonder, Jennifer, how you would respond to the fact that we do have in present state, post young adult stage, a significant amount of single parent homes, of the realities in the economy and in, of course, just the social fabric. And yet, and we have to provide care and attention to the to these people. We want to be able to present not only an economic structure, but really holistically solutions across every stage of where one may be. So I'm all for the idea of if you're in a ditch, stop digging.
Yeah, right.
but to where we are right now, post-sexual revolution, how do we kind of address some of those matters as it pertains to the current state of affairs?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this very question for a long time. And one of the things that we came up with around 2013, the Supreme Court overturned DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and it overturned Proposition 8. Which, as you know, I was very involved with Proposition 8 and following it closely and so on. And I remember thinking at the time, if the Supreme Court, and this is a long-winded answer, but I'm coming to your question of what to do. If the Supreme Court can simply make up law as they go along, if they can get things so wrong, there's not really much point in launching another political campaign or going for another issues-type election. If they can just wipe it out with the court decision, you know, that just doesn't, we don't have enough resources to make these futile gestures of, you know, winning elections. I mean, we won Prop 8. We won it decisively. You know, there was no question that we won it. So I started thinking, well, what can we do? And this is when I started thinking about the millions of people who have been harmed by various aspects of the sexual revolution. And this, of course, is way beyond gay marriage or DOMA or anything like that. Just thinking broadly, as you just did, the issues of broken families and families that never formed in the first place, and what demographers call multiple partner fertility, what the people in crisis pregnancy centers see in terms of not only the lifestyle problems that people have trying to take care of their children and stuff, but the regret that they have about their abortions, you know, all of these things that are socially invisible that nobody ever talks about because that's all, you know, has to be tamped down, you know, if you're going to keep the dream alive, that all of those negative consequences of the sexual revolution have to be dismissed and hidden. So we conceived of the idea of starting to explicitly describe the survivors and victims of the sexual revolution. And we'd use the term survivor because it's more hopeful, but implied in survivor is the fact that you went through something that could have killed you, you know? And so what we try to do is to focus on the various ways people have been harmed and find those people and give them a platform to talk about their experience so that other people can know that this is not a made up thing, you know?
Is there a sense, Jennifer, in which it sounds like you were thinking about this even before the Me Too movement?
Oh, gosh, yes.
But I wonder if, in a way, the Me Too movement is sort of the left's admission that the sexual revolution has had victims.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting point that you make, because a lot of people, I view the Me Too movement as kind of an opportunity to talk about the bigger picture. Because what a lot of people want to do with Me Too is to say, well, I'm against abuse. I'm against harassment. I'm against some of the terrible things that go on the internet. but I still want to be sex positive, which is the term people use for saying, I still want to endorse the sexual revolution. I don't want to be a Christian nut job. You know, that's really what they're trying to say.
Don't want to be a prude.
I don't want to be a prude. That's right. I want to endorse the overall zeitgeist. I just want to patch it up a little bit.
Yeah.
It's my considered opinion that those lines that you're trying to draw, they're not going to hold. None of those.
Seem to me for my single male friends to be dangerous ground to walk on legally. Because on one hand they're saying, we still want the sexual revolution and the sort of benefits that come from it, but we're ready to throw you in jail. If you look at someone the wrong way, and men being right. Men, if I were them, I'm a happily married man who doesn't have to worry about this anymore. If I were them, I'd be very careful with the trap that they are setting with what you described.
That's right. That's right. And the reason is, David, the reason is that the proving an allegation of sexual misconduct is intrinsically difficult because nobody's there except the two participants, and they both have every incentive to describe what happened in terms that benefit themselves. So, you know, there are plenty of cases where people have really been harmed by a sexual encounter, where it really was would meet the threshold of legal, you know, of a crime in some way, whether it's a minor or an adult or whatever. There are plenty of cases where that happens, but you can't prove it. Okay. I mean, you just can't bring forward evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. So on the other side of it, so if you actually have been victimized, that reduces the chance of you actually getting justice. On the other hand, it means that the possibility for false accusation is a lot, very live possibility, very deadly, dangerous possibility. And it's because the nature of the sexual act is private. It's intrinsically supposed to be private, right? And when you've got a system that endorses a casual attitude towards all of that, you can't really adjudicate these cases. You know what I mean? I mean, the criminal justice system isn't really set up to deal with that kind of stuff. It deals with public information and verifiable evidence and all that kind of stuff. And so you are going to have problems. And so that's one of the reasons I think that the premise of the sexual revolution is fundamentally flawed. Because the premise, if you look back to people like Alfred Kinsey and Wilhelm Reich and all these other people who really the intellectual fathers of this stuff, what they wanted to say, David, was that the taboos, all the sexual taboos are harmful. If we could just get rid of the sexual taboos, everybody could do whatever they wanted. No one would ever get hurt. Briefly, that's what these guys thought. I might be exaggerating, but not by very much. You know what I mean? I mean, this is what they thought. You got to get rid of the taboos. And the problem is the taboos were doing a lot of work. The taboos were getting a lot of things done. They were protecting people because they were keeping people out of the dorm room past 10 o'clock. You know, you could not be in the dorm room after 10 o'clock. You know, you can verify, was he in the dorm room after 10 or wasn't he? You know, you don't have to get into, did she mean to take off her pants in front of him? Or, you know what I mean? You don't have to get into that, all those other areas. So the taboos were getting something done. And that's what the Me Too people and a lot of the secular people, they don't want to face that. And I hope that some of the stories that we tell at the Ruth Institute can help people see that you need to get past that. You know, that's the very barrier you need to overcome.
Well, and back to kind of the initial setup of our conversation, there's a profoundly economic implication to this, because as you point out, those of us who are defenders of free markets, or at least are defending the right thing in what I believe to be the right way, are sticklers for contract law, for keeping commitments. Family is an institution where that is not only learned, but hopefully modeled. And in a family dynamic where these virtues are cultivated and taught, you create people who go into the work, into the marketplace, then with some of these same virtues. And so there is a sense in which the topic has a direct correlation just by nature of some of the sin qua nons of markets and contracts come out of the dynamic you describe around a family. But I also believe that there is a kind of macro and demographic reality. You and I spoke together at a conference years ago about the housing crisis.
Oh, yeah.
Being really more of a home crisis, that when we treated houses as trading cards instead of a place to raise children, to have shared experiences, to make memories, to, you know, prepare young people for adulthood, all these things, that there was this kind of cultural and moral lesson in the financial crisis that transcended collateralized debt obligations. Well, as we come upon now yet another anniversary of the infamous Roe v. Wade decision, as we look to what the Supreme Court will be doing in the months ahead with Dobbs. As you and I are recording, we both happen to be in Washington, D.C. For different events and meetings and things, and you'll be and your institution participating in the Walk for Life efforts of the weekend. I wonder if you could, even beyond the moral and personal and emotional and cultural dynamics of the abortion travesty that you and I would agree on anything you would say and I would say, but do you have any thoughts on what it has done economically? Because in 1976, 3 years past Roe, you hadn't had a huge opportunity to see what it would mean to birth rates, to family formation, to home formation. Now you fast forward, and because Roe was passed the year before I was born, I can do the math as to how long it's been law of the land. We're coming up on 50 years, and it seems to me the data is overwhelming at what the implications of a long period of time of flawed household formation may have looked like. What has abortion meant? What are declining fertility rates mean to America's economic prosperity?
Well, I love how you ask simple questions, David.
Yeah. And short ones.
Yeah. So first of all, just the birth rate, you know, that with, what is it, 60 million deaths in America alone, not to mention worldwide, how many people have been murdered, you know, how many lives have been lost. Those people would be in their peak productive years now, right? Your peak earning, peak productive years are between the ages of 30 and 50, right? And so those people are gone. And they'd be doing stuff. They'd have been building things. They would have been inventing things. They would be, you know, they'd be maintaining the society that we have. When we look around us with the planned economic slowdown that was created by the threat of a novel virus and how everybody kind of lost their minds over what to do, you can see if people don't work, stuff doesn't happen, you know, and there are problems. And so if you allow your mind to think about, well, what could have happened? What new things could we have done? What new problems could we have solved if we'd had those people? It's pretty amazing. And the fact is that the so-called population explosion has never happened. It has never been the threat that people said it was going to be. The fact the population continues to grow has happened because of what the demographers call it demographic momentum. And it's because people are not dropping like flies. It's not because they're breeding like bunnies. It's because people are no longer dropping like flies the way they used to. And so birth rates around the world are below replacement fertility in virtually every developed country that you can think of.
But I think when you and I first met and throughout the first several years of our relationship, America was still at that break-even level.
But we're not anymore.
Right.
And we were then, David, because the Hispanics were coming over and they were having more kids. Now,
I also think Gen X did an okay job. You know, the 2.1 was right around there. We didn't go above it. And there were certain segments. There's obviously people waiting much longer to get married now.
That's right.
But the 2.1.
We got to come back to that point.
We will. I do think you're right. That is a separate subject that really requires some additional treatment. But I guess there's a chicken or egg thing here. I have my opinions, but I want to hear yours because I'll probably change mine to match yours.
Ah.
Are declining, where we've dropped now to 1.8, 1.7, 1.6. We're not to Europe yet. We're not to Japan yet. I pray we don't get there.
Right.
But our declining birth rate has accelerated post-GFC, the great financial crisis. Did the great financial crisis cause the declining birth rate? Or do we have financial crises because of declining birth rates? In other words, what's the chicken or egg in all this?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question, okay. David. You tell me. I'll agree with you.
Okay.
That'll be our plan on that one.
What I think is it's a negative feedback loop where it doesn't matter. Yes. It doesn't matter.
Yes, I think there's something to that. Financial instability and insecurity makes people less willing to reproduce. That's
and being
true.
less willing to reproduce creates more financial instability.
That's right. Yeah. The other thing that I want to say about abortion, though, is that it's the linchpin of the sexual revolution in the following sense. If you want to create a world where everybody can have sex without having any problems, without, you know, you have to sterilize it. You have got to sterilize the sexual act. Yeah. Otherwise, it's intrinsically social act. It's like a very social act because this is where you get new people, you know. And this is how men and women bond to each other, is through the sexual act. That's what's supposed to happen. It's supposed to be social. So in order to make it a private consumption good, you've got to sterilize it. And abortion is the guarantee that it will be sterilized. Contraception does not always work. We know that. The people who promote it, the people who produce it, they know about the contraceptive failure rates in ordinary use and actual real-time situations. They know it doesn't work. So you got to have abortion as a backup plan. So when you think about that, process that in your mind a little bit, you can see that the abortion ideology, or what I call the contraceptive ideology, that's what I call it in the book, The Sexual State. When you think about that ideology and its corrosive effect, what it means is that people are going around messing around in situations that cannot sustain a pregnancy. You know, they're having sex with people that they're not married to or who are married to someone else, right? So you're now destabilizing somebody else's existing relationship, right? Abortion and contraception makes it look like that's going to be okay. And then you only find out after the fact that, gee whiz, there was all this stuff they didn't tell me about, right? By the time you figure it out by experience, you've made a big mess that you can't easily recover from. And so a lot of the brokenness and failure, families failing to form, a lot of that has to be laid at the doorstep of Roe v. Wade. That is the accelerator. And you probably are familiar with this article that George Akerlof and Janet Yellen did years ago that was analyzing the fact that the advent of modern contraception and abortion actually is correlated with more out-of-wedlock pregnancy. Right? It's correlated with more, not less. And how is that possible? And the way they argue it is sort of what I just did, is basically say you've changed the social sexual regime, you could say, under which people enter into sexual relationships. And if you have a contraceptive failure, you either kill the baby or you become a single mom. You don't just go marry the guy, which was the regime prior to Roe. So it's had vast consequences. And the cost of family fragmentation is enormous. Back in the day, David, prior to the Obergefell decision, there were a number of people doing studies of the taxpayer cost of family breakdown. And at that time, I want to say it was 2012, a study was done showing the taxpayer cost of non-marital childbearing and divorce was $212 billion per year, which at that time was the GDP of New Zealand, that Americans were spending in tax dollars cleaning up the problems associated with parents not being married to each other, you know. And I'm sure that it's on the same scale and probably worse by now. And that doesn't count the private costs. That doesn't count the private costs. You know, families that I saw something not too long ago on retirement planning, and this is right down your alley. You probably know these numbers better than I do. The average American between the age of 55 and 65 doesn't have very much money saved, right? You know, there's like, but if you look at the Americans of that age group who have been married, who have had multiple partner fertility, 80% of them have zero They have nothing saved and they're 55 years old. So it's just, you can't accumulate if you don't have stability in the family. If you're switching out partners, switching out households, supporting multiple households, you cannot accumulate any wealth privately. So it's a big problem. And then you're more dependent on the government, which is another negative feedback loop.
And so the issue about when one gets married, and I think this is probably the predominant sociological phenomena I see in more upscale communities that are still mm-hmm. radically secular, is not a shunning of marriage and not even a shunning of children, although certainly anything over one, and if you're really, really old-fashioned, maybe two. It's my wife and mine's joke in Upper West Side that we know the Christian families in about 5 seconds because they have more than two kids with them.
Right.
And there's not a lot, but there are some, and it does seem to very often be faith oriented.
Right.
But there does seem to be, Charles Murray wrote about this in Coming Apart, particularly as it pertains to white America. There is a reasonably nostalgic, if not convenient, embrace of family in wealthier parts of American culture, that the family unit has not been sustained as much in poorer parts of white America. There's a chicken or egg issue there too, no doubt. But even in those areas where they don't, divorce is not very popular, not necessarily even very common. It's below trend rate to some degree.
Yep.
I don't think there's a lot of moral judgmentalism about adultery per se, but generally speaking, it looks better to the family unit when they're still, and to the reputation of people to kind of stay married. But they're doing this in their 30s. They're doing this sometimes into their 40s. And most of it, what I hear, and I'm talking, by the way, Jennifer, even inside the church, particularly more evangelical churches, there is a belief that, no, we want to be married. We want to wait to have kids. However, we need to have our careers up and running before we get married. And this is something that's particularly problematic for me because I have enjoyed a very successful career and developed a lot of the economic blessings that God has been gracious enough to give to me throughout my career, but all of it with my wife at my side. When my wife married me, this was not the case.
Right.
And so I feel this strong fondness for the idea of going through the pits and mountains together. And yet I see now a lot of people seem to believe marriage should be something you delve into after you've reached the top of the mountain economically. Maybe I've gone on too long about it, but I'd wonder if you'd comment on what you're observing in the sense and what you feel about it, both socially and economically.
Well, I think you put your finger on a very important point. And honestly, when I started the Ruth Institute in 2008, David, this is exactly what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk to college girls about why they didn't need to wait until they were 35 to get married and start a family, because my husband and I had already been through infertility for exactly this reason, right? We put it off. We're going to wait till I get tenure, all of that kind of mentality that is very common among the educated professional classes, right? The plain fact of the matter is that entry into the professions, and the cost of entering, is delayed fertility. The professions are not set up for you to work part-time as a tenured professor. It's not set up for you to come back and get a law degree at age 40, which, by the way, is what Phyllis Schlafly did and what Ruth Bader Ginsburg did. In their era, that is what you did. You raised your family and then you went and did something. So the influence of feminism, the thing that called itself feminism, the thing that owned the public space, that was allowed to say, we speak for women, they put all of their energy into equality at every step of the way, which does not work. because of the different fertility patterns of men and women. It just doesn't work. It doesn't have the same impact on me as a woman as it does on you as a guy. So that was a major wrong turn. It was a wrong turn that was supported, you know, across the board. It took very little to get big business to sign on to that, which is kind of interesting. It took very little for to get the universities to sign on to that. And yet at the same time, our friends at Students for Life will tell you that college campuses are no more friendly today to a pregnant student. They're no more friendly today than they were 50 years ago. You know, you're just supposed to get rid of the baby. That's how you finish your college career and so on. So there were many places where choices could have gone differently. But in fact, we embraced this path that said equality at every stage, which ends up leaving a lot of women with fewer children than they really wanted, and postponing marriage, postponing childbearing, and staying in the workplace longer than they wanted. The other thing we haven't mentioned yet, that is one of the drivers of this, is no-fault divorce. See, because when Ruth Bader Ginsburg got married, she knew she could put her husband through whatever, and that used to be a thing, PhD, putting hubby through medical school, putting hubby through law school, and then you'd stay home and have kids, and then when the kids were grown, you'd do something else, and you could have a life together knowing that you weren't going to get ditched when he got his, and now he runs off the secretary and you have nothing. You know, no-fault divorce unhinged that whole lifetime contract idea, right? And so everybody's optimizing at every point. You can't jointly optimize over the lifetime anymore. I know this is kind of techie talk, but your people are probably used to this kind of talk. So we can be honest with each other and talk full econ nerd talk. But you know, that's what you're talking about now. It's instead of optimizing jointly over the lifetime, you're optimizing individually point by point. And it doesn't take much to figure out that there are economic benefits from long-term cooperation that we're now throwing away.
I agree completely. And I think that your point is quantifiable. Yep. That when you only optimize certain periods of life instead of the whole thing, that there is an opportunity cost.
Bingo.
I also wonder if it increases divorce. And I say this as a successful male professional, but I'm not sure that I could ever have trusted a woman the way I trust my wife if she married me after I was rich.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about building riches together.
Together, right.
That I think strengthens the bonds of that marriage. And it doesn't just have to be material riches. Right. I'm sort of referring to, I'm only using that as an example because it's what I hear from other people that they want to first get financially comfortable. And I always wonder why they think that they would have that same trust in their partner if their partner wasn't comfortable marrying them until they were financially comfortable. Like there's just something, I guess.
There's a gold digger aspect.
I mean, that's a kind of really obvious example of it, but even more subtly than that, even if it isn't as crass as a just explicit gold digger, even just someone that you didn't trust you enough until you were stable that way, as opposed to having that trust, that sacrifice, that builds the relationship together. Maybe I should put Jolene on the podcast sometime, and she could explain why in the world she stuck with me, you know, in the hard days. But I mean, we know the answer, and why any loving spouse, people that love each other, do that. They go through those things together, and it makes me sad that so many people are not experiencing together the natural challenges of young adult professional life.
Or just young adult any life, you know.
That's problem, right. It's true. Yeah.
And in fact, it's probably more important for people with fewer financial resources that they have some stability in those relationships. And you know, between the welfare state and the ideology of the sexual revolution that's been stripped away from people, poor people used to get married and stay married. Poor people used to stick with each other. It used to be, and I think, you know, we're probably coming down to the wire here. So let me just state. Traditional Christian sexual ethics created equality on a profound level, because traditional Christian sexual ethics says for every child, their own mother and their own father. For every man, one and only one wife. For every woman, one and only one husband. For life, for everybody, regardless of income, right? And that created equality. That created stability. That created justice. That's justice. That's honest to goodness justice right there.
Well, Jennifer, in the tradition of some of the great teachers throughout history, including economists, I think one of the last times I saw you, you and I spent a little time talking about John Muir's book, Redeeming Economics, and this concept. My friend Ryan Anderson, who was recently on the podcast, has spoken quite a bit about this triple A notion from Aristotle to Augustine to Aquinas. There is a long precedent of people who have believed, as you do, that the family unit and the virtue of individuals matters to economic outcomes. And I appreciate the work you're doing to continue this movement. And I hope that listeners to our podcast today will have their understanding of how these things are far more connected than we realize, strengthened. And I really appreciate you coming on, and I hope you'll be a guest again on Capitol Record.
David, thank you so much for calling me and inviting me to do this. It's been a great pleasure, and I look forward to hearing the finished product and sharing it with the Ruth Institute followers too.
I appreciate it very much. We'll be sharing it far and wide. I'm going to be encouraging listeners to support the Ruth Institute. I'm very fond of what you're doing and appreciative. There's robust division of labor, another economic concept those of us in the classical school care about. But there's a division of labor in the not just in the marketplace, but in our movement, and the cause that has animated you and that you are bringing your giftedness to is a pivotal one, and I thank you for it.
Thank you, David.
Well, I do hope, as always, you enjoyed today's discussion. I will not be upset if you want to send me hate email that you think we delve too much into sexuality and family and this and that. And that's fine. If you disagree, I get it. And yet I want to be real clear. The purpose of it was specific. It was intentional. There are podcasts that are there to really hit home very important points about the family unit and about sexual ethics, about cultural morality. And that was not, my beliefs are on all those issues, and Jennifer does too. But the reason I brought it into Capitol Record today was specifically economic, that I do believe strong families lead to a stronger economic capacity in the society. I do believe that the sustainability of free markets requires strong personal discipline, strong personal morality, self-restraint, and that the institution of family has civilizationally proven to be integral in creating the milieu that we want in a growing economy and in a functioning society that contains the preconditions for human flourishing. So I hope Jennifer has at least provoked you to think about where some of these post-sexual revolution dynamics play into what we believe about economic order and what they in fact have done. And so it was a pleasure to have Jennifer on. We definitely will do it again. Look forward to your feedback and appreciate your support of the Capitol Record and our efforts to make this the most influential podcast out there, making the case for a free and virtuous society, a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to the Capitol Record.